He's been a legend in the eyes of Indiana basketball fans for a long, long time. And now he'll be immortalized for all the basketball world to see. A child of the Depression, he knew nothing about having money while growing up in Terre Haute, but he did know how to have fun. And he learned a lot of hard lessons along the way. After a standout basketball career at Terre Haute Gerstmeyer High School, he landed a basketball scholarship to Indiana University, where he helped lead the Hoosiers to the 1953 National Championship. After a two-year hitch in the Army, he entered the NBA, where he played seven seasons before shoulder injuries forced retirement. He then became a coach, something he was perfectly suited to do. But, like he always says, a jockey can't carry the horse across the finish line. His teams didn't have enough talent to win, so he was let go after brief stops in Chicago and Baltimore. He moved his family back to Kokomo to take a job selling glass rings, figuring he was done with basketball. But a couple of years later, the ABA was formed, and after the league's first season, the Indiana Pacers came calling, needing a new coach. He took the job reluctantly, figuring it was just a good way to pay off his new furniture. But this time, he had talent to work with. He wound up coaching the Pacers to three ABA titles, and eventually into the NBA. His NBA teams lacked adequate ownership, so he was let go again after four seasons. But he soon returned in a new role that carries on to this day, radio analyst. He's been immersed in Indiana basketball for eight decades now, as a player, coach, and broadcaster. And he's finally been recognized for it, because he'll go into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame on Friday. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Bobby Slick Leonard.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions. They make your memories last forever.
Welcome to One-on-One. This is Mark Monteith coming to you from the living room of Bob and Nancy Leonard in Carmel, Indiana. Slick, you grew up in Terre Haute. You certainly had an interesting upbringing there. What do you recall of your childhood there?
I was born during the Depression. You know, I can remember standing in commodity lines back then on Saturdays in an old building. Of course, we lived on the railroad tracks, but an old building, you'd take a gunny sack and they'd give you a little flour, a little sugar, some canned goods. But, you know, times were really tough. And my dad only went to the fourth grade, and my mom went to the sixth grade. So, you know, it was tough. And we lived not more than 40 yards off the railroad tracks in what then they called a shotgun house. There was a front room, a bedroom, and a kitchen, and an outhouse and an outdoor pump, outdoor water. You had to pump water, and you had a potbelly stove in the front room. Everybody slept in the one bedroom, and you had a kitchen there with an old wood-burning stove, and you go out and pump water. You go out and pump water if you want to take a bath. When they go back to those cowboy movies, taking a bath on Saturday night, you take a tub of water, pump a tub full of water, put it on that old stove in the kitchen and heat it up and take a bath once a week. So it was, you know, the funny thing about Terre Haute, of course, we lived about two and a half blocks right there on the railroad tracks from the train depot, which is now where Indiana State is.
Okay.
Indiana State's built buildings there. That's why Terre Haute was called the Crossroads of America. That's where east to west, north to south, crossed right in Terre Haute. And I used to stand out in front of that old shotgun house and watch the Dixie Limited go by. Yeah. And those people were headed down to Florida, you know, and they were in the dining car, and they'd wave at me. And I always wondered where they were going. Yeah, my dad at that time was what they called a plumber's helper, which was a ditch digger. And I can remember he made $12 a week.
Wow.
12 bucks a week. But, you know, you didn't notice it because everybody around you, everybody there in that little neighborhood, which was predominantly Catholic neighborhood, all lived right there on the railroad tracks. Nobody had anything. So, you know, we were all in the same ball game.
Yeah, you weren't comparing yourself to anyone else.
No, we didn't even know about it. But that's where I started. Right down the alley, Mark, was Solomon's backyard. And there was an old barn there that was about to fall down, leaning, but it had a basketball goal on it. And that's where I started. That's where I spent all my time. And when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, we had 12 guys in the neighborhood. I'm talking about predominantly Catholic neighborhood. We had 12 guys that were in high school at the time, juniors. Some of them were juniors and some seniors. And at that time, they joined the Marine Corps. Boy, I remember them so well. Willie Heck, Paul Daly, the four Sullivan brothers, Ty Bensley. I remember those guys, and they joined the Marine Corps. And they were in all the major invasions in the South Pacific in World War II, Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima. But when they came back, they hadn't finished high school. And Gershmeyer Tech, it was really Tech. They called it Tech. Mm-hmm. Because it was wood shop, print shop, auto shop, metal shop, all the shops to get you ready for whatever. And when they came back, they tore that old barn down. Those guys tore that old barn down. That was in 45. I think I was in the 7th grade or whatever. And all of them made it back from all those invasions. They all made it back. And they went to night school, and they welded a beautiful basketball goal. Beautiful basketball goal. Tore the barn down where I'd been shooting for years, all during the war, and tore the barn down, and man, we had an outdoor basketball court, and there was no oak tree there, and they put a light in there. I was over there till midnight, 2 or 3 in the morning. Then on Sunday afternoon, we'd have games. We'd set up on Sullivan's back porch, and they'd have coffee, and we'd have games. And those guys were older, you know, older. Yeah. And they knocked the daylights out of me. But those guys, those Marines, followed me all the way through high school, all the way through IU, and even came down to St. Louis to some pro games when I was playing in the NBA. So I'll never forget those guys.
Yeah,
because they had a lot to do with my life.
That's the perfect launching pad. You got a place to play, and you got older guys who are better than you teaching you. I mean, that sounds like an ideal situation looking back.
Yeah, I know. And when there was nobody there, I used to shoot by myself. But I had an imaginary friend that I always played, and he never beat me.
Did you give this friend a name?
I call him different names, but I had an imaginary friend, and I'd shoot and make, and he'd shoot and miss. But we go to the wire, I beat him right at the end. It was some way to come up, because nobody in my family were athletes. Uh-huh. You know, there wasn't nobody in the family. My dad never played sports. My dad never played no sports. Like I said, he went to the 4th grade. But
yeah,
those guys in the Marine Corps, when they came back, were the guys.
Yeah.
That really.
Now, going back to your boyhood, did you have to kind of, because you were so poor, did you learn to hustle a little bit? I read something once where you and a buddy took Eskimo pies downtown and for a dime a piece.
You do everything. You know, just try to get a little spending money. I cut grass, had an old push lawnmower, cut grass, pushed an ice cream cart. So we'd go get this ice cream cart up at a place called 12 Points. Well, I knew in Terre Haute that all the money was on the other side of Wabash Avenue, the south side. Mm-hmm. I knew that's where, if there was any money in Terre Haute, that's where it was. So I pushed that ice cream cart. Eskimo pies were a nickel. So you made a penny a piece. And the guy that owned the thing made 4 cents off of Eskimo pie. Well, I pushed it down to the south side, and I sold them for a dime. I was making 6 cents. I was making more than the guy that owned the business. I sold for a dime.
I've read articles, and I've read some of your stories. Like about the time you were swimming in the Wabash River and you were sliding down the bank and cut yourself on a broken bottle or something like that.
Yeah.
And you still got scars for that. Or you fell through the lid of a vinegar barrel? Fell through the lid?
Well, I fell through the sand pit thing over at the railroad yards. And we could have suffocated in there. But, you know, you look back on your life and you say, how many circumstances You know, you're lucky to be alive, some of the things you did. Mm-hmm. But kids do those things.
Yeah.
And I used to swim in the Wabash River. I didn't know how dirty it was at that time or anything. That was the only place to go swimming. And I've been in that thing, got caught in undercurrents and things like that. But I developed into being a pretty good swimmer. But, yeah, we had an exciting life where you had to spend no money.
Slick becomes acquainted with Hoosier hysteria when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with an encore presentation of my 2009 conversation with Slick Leonard. He grew up like a lot of kids in Indiana back in the 1940s, dreaming of winning a state championship. He didn't accomplish that, but he did fall in love.
Did your motivation to play basketball or to be an athlete come from playing with those older guys, or were there other ways? Was it the high school games? You weren't watching games on television then, so
where did the spark come from to
be a player?
Mark, that's all there was to do. I mean, you could work, like cutting grass and all those things that I did, or you could play ball. So I played everything. I taught myself how to play tennis and ended up being number one player in tennis, and played football, baseball, you name it. You played it all. But I had that, there was something about a ball going through a net that caught hold of me, just like it did a lot of kids.
Yeah.
Just like it did a lot of kids. You know, back then, it seemed like, Mark, now, you know, I know today gyms are open and kids can go in there. Well, they used to lock the gym up back then when school was out, or, you know, practice was over, they locked the gym. You'd never get in the gym. So you're always, in the wintertime, shoveling snow off of someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Either it's down there at Sullivan's shoveling that snow off, or over at McLean Junior High School, they had an outdoor basket there, shoveling that off. Every place you went, it seems like. And the only thing you could do on high school games, and I can remember this very well, in March, you're out playing wherever, in an alley or wherever it is. You're out playing, and somebody would plug in a radio, and you'd be listening to the state tournament. The state tournament, and I'll never forget that. It became, not only for me, but there were 714 teams in the state tournament then. Every little town had its own school, its own team. And the dream, you had a dream, and you got a dream. You had a dream that one day you were going to be on a team. It was called Butler Fieldhouse then.
Uh-huh.
Got to the Final Four at Butler Fieldhouse. And that drove you. You know, you had to go through your sectional, your regional, your semi-state, and then to the Final Four. And you always had that dream.
Yeah.
You always had that dream.
Slick Leonard goes to the state tournament, but it's not what he expects when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. This is Mark Monteith with Slick Leonard. Slick, you were talking before the break about your dream of playing in the state high school basketball tournament.
Did you go to the state tournament before you were in high school at all? Did you ever have a chance to go see it?
I was a freshman in high school at Tech, Gershmeyer Tech.
Yeah, Terre Haute, Gershmeyer Tech, yeah.
I was a freshman in high school, and Howard Sharp, who was a great coach.
Your high school coach.
Great coach, great fundamentalist. He saw something in me because I was only 5'4.5" and weighed 103 pounds when I was a freshman in high school. And so he had tickets. Each school got so many tickets. So the seniors were going to get to go to the state, to the Final Four. Sharpie talked them in, because nobody had cars at my high school, maybe a couple. Sharpie said, you guys give him a ride. And Sharpie gave me a ticket. Well, they didn't want to do it. Those seniors didn't want to do it, because I hadn't established myself at all.
You're just
so
a freshman.
Right. We go to the state tournament. I got 30 cents in my pocket. I got 30 cents and a ticket. We go out to Butler Fieldhouse for the afternoon game. And after the afternoon game, you know, it's common knowledge where everybody went back then. They went down there to that girly show between games. I can't remember
downtown
the name.
Someplace?
Somewhere. Yeah, downtown somewhere. So I walked, after the afternoon game, I walked from Butler Fieldhouse all the way down to the circle. And I never will forget, I had to hang around by myself. I had 30 cents in my pocket. I went to a place on the Circle then. This was in 1947. Garfield of Terre Haute was in the state Final Four with Clyde LaVellet, who's a Hall of Famer now,
right.
Went to Kansas.
Right.
And I went down there on the Circle, and there was a Blacker's Chili Parlor. And I went in there and got a Coke and a bowl of chili. Guess how much it cost me?
30 cents.
30 cents. Now I'm busted. But I hung around down there and then walked back out to Butler Fieldhouse for the evening game. And Shelbyville upset. Garfield was undefeated going into that championship game. And Shelbyville beat him. And later, with Bill Garrett, who later went to IU, was a senior at IU when I was a freshman at IU, Bill. Mm-hmm. And then those guys rode me back to Terre Haute in the car. That was my experience, first time ever, the Final Four.
Well, that had to be a motivator, too, though. I mean, just seeing a person like that as a freshman in high school.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. I wish everybody had the opportunity. Every kid from all over the state of Indiana that had a letter jacket or whatever had it on. They're coming from all over the place. And that just made your desire that much greater.
You were probably out playing ball the next day, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I played it every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
When you were in high school playing, how did you do in the state tournament? What was the best you did?
The best we did, we got to the regional final at Martinsville, where Johnny Wooden's from. The regional final, the Martinsville gym was one of the first gyms built in the state of Indiana that seated more people than the population of the town when
right,
they built it.
Right.
That's where the regional final was, at Martinsville. Mm-hmm. And Ellettsville, which is right outside of Bloomington. A kid by the name of Don Hanna, I never will forget it. Don Hanna hit a shot, was in the air at the buzzer that beat us.
Yeah.
Or otherwise we'd been at the semi-state at Bloomington.
Yeah.
And that broke my heart. I mean, that devastated me, just like a lot of kids when they lose out in the state tournament. But we did win the sectional in Terre Haute and got to the regional final.
You were talking earlier about recruiting. You looked at Louisville, Kentucky, Notre Dame, what is it, NC State, I think you said?
North Carolina State.
Yeah.
See, old Ev Case, the old Gray Fox, Ev Case, won two state championships in 36 and 39 at Frankfort. And then he got a college job, and it was North Carolina State. So he was coming back and recruiting in Indiana.
See? Yeah. So this is, let's see, what year did you get out of high school?
1950.
Did you get any inducements to go to college then? Were colleges doing that?
No.
No favors?
When I went to Indiana, well,
not
some were, but I don't think they checked them as close.
Right.
But
the rules were less certain then, I think. I mean,
yeah. And I remember I went down to Kentucky, and I went down there, and it was, you know, in the summertime, and Adolf Rupp said, "We've got our 12th man off our varsity that's in summer school." So he wanted me to go over to the gym down there at Lexington, and play a game to 30 against this kid that was 12th man on their varsity team. Well, I beat his butt. And when I did, right away, as soon as I could get dressed, Adolf had me down to a hotel down there in Lexington with three doctors trying to make a deal.
What kind of deal? What were they going to do?
Well, you know, it wasn't the kind of things you... Well, there was some things involved there that I didn't get at Indiana.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah. Well, Adolf was famous for that. I mean, he knew how to get players. You played this kid to 30 one-on-one, huh?
Yeah, me and him one-on-one.
Half court or full court?
Half court.
Half court.
I nailed him.
It's bedlam in Bloomington as the Hoosiers win the national championship. And we'll relive it as my conversation with Slick Leonard continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with upcoming Hall of Fame inductee, Slick Leonard. He could have gone several places to play college basketball, but he stayed close to home to go to IU. There, he was a big part of the team that won the national championship in 1953. A vital part, in fact.
So you go to Indiana, and you know you're going to win a national championship your junior year. But what was it like playing for Branch McCracken?
Wonderful, wonderful. Branch to this day, you know, he was like a father to me. He was like a father. Freshmen weren't eligible to play then. You only got to play varsity your sophomore, junior, senior year. Branch was wonderful. One of the fathers of the fast break, along with Piggy Lambert up Purdue. They called them the Hurrying Hoosiers.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about that before I ever got there. Full court pressure, fast break, rebounding, simple offense. The Big Bear, he was some kind of guy.
Now, before we get to that NCAA championship game, one of your highlights at IU was meeting Nancy, to whom you're still married. I believe that happened during your freshman year?
Freshman
at
year.
IU?
Freshman year.
How did you meet her?
I met her in a class. Yeah, I met Nancy.
I think I read that you used to stick your foot in the aisle when she'd walk by to get her attention.
Yeah, I'd do anything. Yeah, yeah. Nancy. She's been wonderful. She's been wonderful. Yeah.
But didn't it take you a while
to
win her
to copy off of her? You know, hey, I went.
You weren't the most serious student, were you?
Well, I was serious when I had to be. You know, when you're taking anatomy and physiology and some of those things, you know, you have to do the work.
And then I read that after either your first date or one of your dates, you called her 5 minutes later and said, "Well, will you?"
Yeah.
Is this true?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
And then she said, "What?" And you said,
"Will you?" I probably said it, will you? And will you go with me?
Yeah, go steady.
Go steady. Yeah. I was a cocky kid on a basketball floor, but really I was a very, very shy kid.
Was she from a different kind of background? I mean, did she?
Yes, yes. Nancy was from her father owned a small roofing company in South Bend. And she came, Nancy's family, they had religion in her life. You know, Nancy grew up in the church and that. You know, I think of South Bend, he had that small roofing company. Her father's name was Roy. Had that small roofing company, but he was also a president of the Roofers Union in South Bend. So he had a great rapport with a lot of people in South Bend. And when they built that library out there, and I worked all summer on that roof at the library, which is Touchdown Jesus.
Oh, really? You helped put that roof up. Huh?
I put that roof on there. And he didn't have all the modern equipment you have today either. I was pulling gravel and everything up there with a pulley.
This is why you're at IU.
This is while I was at, I think, one of my first seasons in a program.
Oh, okay. So you're out of college then. Let's go back to your basketball career at IU. You were the team MVP as a sophomore in 1952, and you were an All-American in 53 and 54. You won the national championship your junior year, but before I get to that, the games were rowdy then. I've read where you once got shoved by a Michigan fan as you came off the floor. And there was another time you kind of announced you were going to hit the game-winning shot, you know, and you did, and things like that were going on. It's a whole different environment than it is today.
Yeah, it is. It is. I can remember the shot I hit against Michigan up there. Held the ball and got the shot off at the gun, and I said, "You can kiss it goodbye," and it went in. Well, that's the night that off the floor, I mean, those fans were so upset because this lady tried to hit me with an umbrella. Yeah, you know, there was a lot of feeling.
Now, Swick, it's time we talk about your national championship season at IU. You guys started that season ranked 17th in the country and then worked your way up to number one by the end of the season. You lost your second and third game of that season to Notre Dame by 1 point and then to Kansas State by 2. And your only conference loss was to Minnesota by 2 points. All of your losses, by the way, came on buzzer-beating shots. So you finished that season 19-3 overall and 17-1 in the Big Ten. And then you opened the NCAA tournament with a 2-point win over DePaul as you scored 22 points. And then you beat Notre Dame as your center, Don Schlunt, who was just a sophomore, came up with the first 40-point game in Big Ten history. And then you beat LSU fairly easily, as you had 22 points again. LSU had Bob Pettit then, right?
Bob Pettit. Notre Dame had good teams in those years. And that game at Chicago Stadium, you stop and think about this, the regional was at Chicago Stadium. They had University of Pennsylvania, the Ivy League champion, which, by the way, Dick Harder, the assistant coach with the Pacers, was on that Pennsylvania team. And then Notre Dame And DePaul of Chicago was an at-large team. Ray Meyer, the famous Ray Meyer, was the coach there. Now, you got into Chicago with two Catholic schools in there, and DePaul being right there, and you know how many big, Chicago's big Notre Dame, you know, Notre Dame alumni and fans. And boy, that place was wild. That Chicago Stadium was wild. Yeah, 22,000 in there.
Great atmosphere.
Yeah.
But then you play Kansas in Kansas City for the national championship, and they were the defending champion. Kansas was.
They were.
From what I've read about the game, it was just a monster. I mean, they pressed full court. You guys were running.
It was a battle.
Yeah, it was a battle. I mean, you know, it was no slowing it down. Everybody was going at it.
I don't think either team in that game had more than a two-point lead at any one time. Any one time. Yeah, it went to the wire.
I read that Kansas player B.H. Bourne charged into Charlie Crock. They thought it was his fifth foul, but then Fog Allen protested and got the official score to change his mind and say it was his fourth foul. McCracken goes nuts. There was a three-minute delay. So this is the kind of game it was. And then with 2 minutes left, Crock throws an elbow into a Kansas player's ribs and is called for a personal, then throws the ball up in the air in protest and gets called for a technical.
So the game winds up being tied at 68, and with 27 seconds to go, you get fouled. Was it a scramble for a rebound under the basket?
No, I drove to the hoop.
You drove?
I drove.
Drew a foul?
27 seconds to play.
Okay.
Almost made that shot.
Okay.
Almost made that drive. It rolled off the rim, but I did get fouled.
So there's 27 seconds to go,
and you're at the line in the national championship game.
Do you remember your thoughts going to the line?
Oh, man. You know, to be perfectly honest, I was scared to death.
Yeah.
I've often told the story. After the game, all the sports writers and TV people were in the dressing room, and they were talking to Branch and everything, and then they came over to me and said, Bobby, how did you feel standing there on that free throw line with the national championship hanging in the balance? They said, we just talked to Coach McCracken. He said, you had ice water in your veins. And that's when I did say, I said, if that was ice water, baby, it sure felt awful warm when it was running down my leg. That's about the size of it.
Sure. Well, you'd have to be scared. You missed the first one, and then you hit the second one. Was there any particular way you kind of gathered yourself or calmed yourself down, or do you remember what you were thinking before that second free throw?
No, not really. I had every confidence walking up there that I'd make them both. But we clamped them. We put that 27 seconds that was left, we put the pressure on them, and they couldn't get a shot.
They wound up taking a desperation shot from deep in the corner.
That's right. And I can remember, I can see it to this day, Dick White, our sixth man, Dick White from Terre Haute, Indiana, and went to Terre Haute Wiley, which was Terre Haute South now. I can still see Dick getting that rebound off that thing, because when that shot was taken, I put my head in my hands. I knew the gun was going. I thought, because we'd gotten beat on last-second shots three times during the regular season.
Oh, okay.
And I saw him get that rebound, and it was all over. It was all over.
Woo! What was the celebration like? What do you remember post-game?
It was tremendous. It was tremendous. The dressing rooms in the Kansas City Auditorium weren't really done, really finished at that time. So our hotel was a half a block away. And we had to walk from the arena to our hotel. And the streets were just, there was no cars. It was all IU fans, and the streets were just packed. The hotel was packed. But on the way, you know, they're out, people drinking beer and everything else all the way back to the hotel. And the hotel was packed. You couldn't even get on an elevator. And, it was wild. But it was a lot more wild when we came back.
Well, the next day, you guys spent the night there. You fly back to Indianapolis the next day. And then there's a caravan from Indianapolis to Bloomington, right?
Took a bus from the Indianapolis airport to Bloomington. By the time we got to Martinsville, which is 20 miles from Bloomington, the highway on both sides was just lined with cars all the way.
Yeah.
And then when we came into Bloomington city limits, it was a madhouse.
How do you think your life would be different? What if you had missed both free throws and you guys lost the game?
You'd never forget it.
Yeah. I mean, how would that
You would never forget it. If you lost, I can remember I told you we had to walk back to the hotel half a block. We walked out of the arena, and I never will forget this. There was that Kansas bus. And as I walked by it, I looked in the windows, the look on those kids' faces. They just lost the national championship. You know, the other thing, I remember in Terre Haute, everybody thinks Johnny Wooden won all those national championships at UCLA. Well, his first national championship was at Indiana State in Terre Haute. And I can remember that ball club he had there in 1947. They beat Hamlin in the NAI, which is Division II now.
Right.
That was his first national championship.
That's true.
Vern Mickelson, who later played with the Lakers, and I played with when I was with the Lakers, was on that Hamlin team. But Johnny Wooden on 7th Street in Terre Haute, I used to go, and Johnny told the guy at the back door, to watch the back door, he said, let that young fella in to watch practice. And I used to go in and watch that team practice. And those guys were my idols. That 47 team he had, they were terrific and won the small college national championship.
I can see that if he had stayed there, would you have played for him maybe? I mean, you could
have. I might have.
You know?
I might have.
Yeah, right there in your hometown.
Yep. That would have changed things.
Yeah. I wanted to go back. You know, we were talking about you hitting the game-winning free throws in the 53 championship game. I read that in the first game ever played in Terre Haute Gerstmeyer's new gym, you hit the game-winning free throws in that game, and supposedly somebody else got fouled, and you shooed the guy off the foul line and took the shots yourself.
I may have done that.
It was in the paper. It was in the Indianapolis News.
We didn't get a gym. We did not get a gym. When I was at Gerstmeyer Tech, we didn't get a gym until my senior year. I'd do anything to win a game.
It worked out. But 54, people don't talk about your 54 team, but it was just as good, right? And you guys won the Big Ten again, and you're back in the NCAA tournament. You were 19-3 in the regular season, 12-2 in the Big Ten. You had a bye in the tournament, but then you lost by 1 point to Notre Dame in the first round.
Yeah, we did. No, I told you Notre Dame had. That was I fully believe that game between us and Notre Dame, had we got through that one, I think we'd won back-to-back national championships.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that sticks in my mind. I really feel like we were good enough to win back-to-back championships. But, you know, you throw that baby up, and there might be an upset in the making. But Notre Dame was very good in those years.
But
that took everything out of them.
Yeah, they lost the next game, I think.
Yeah.
You guys were ranked second, and they were ranked sixth, so that was a big-time game.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah. It was a big-timer.
I don't want to be the bearer of bad tidings, but you were 5-20 from the field that game.
Well,
it was an off night for you.
I did not have a good ball game. I go back to that 54 spring, played in the East-West College All-Star game, Madison Square Garden in New York. That's back when they only had one college All-Star game. And I was fortunate enough to be the most valuable player in that game.
Yeah.
And then the very next day, we opened a 21-game tour, the College All-Americans versus the Harlem Globetrotters. And that's when the Trotters were really good. That's before the black players started coming into the NBA. Sold out every arena in this country. You couldn't get a ticket. And ended up with an outdoor game in the Los Angeles Coliseum and drew 85,000.
That's an experience there.
Oh, yeah. I met a lot of great guys along that way. A lot of guys that are in the Hall of Fame today played were on the College All-American team. So it's been a joy ride.
Slick Leonard brings stories galore when this encore presentation of One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with an encore presentation of my 2009 conversation with Slick Leonard. Nobody in basketball has more stories than him, so let's hear a few, like how he got his nickname and about that historic plane crash.
You joined the Minneapolis Lakers in 1956. We might as well get it out. You've told the story a million and one times, but tell people how you got the nickname Slick.
George Mikan. the first great front line in basketball, great front line, and they won 4 world championships in 5 years or thereabouts, was the Minneapolis Lakers with George Mikan, Vern Mikkelson, and Jim Pollard, that front line. Well, George had just retired and became coach of the Lakers. And we drafted a player by the name of Hot Rod Hundley, who still was my roommate for 5 years, but he still does games for the Utah Jazz. Rod was a huge name in West Virginia, where he came from. So they thought, well, we'll take a couple of exhibition games down to West Virginia. So we go into Morgantown, where West Virginia is, the first night. And then after the game, we're going to play in another town about 120 miles away. But you had to go up through the mountains in West Virginia. So George Mikan and myself, we're sitting in the front seat. Everybody goes to sleep on the bus. George and I are sitting up there with those two little peep lights playing Hollywood Gin. Well, we got up into the mountains. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning, 12:30, 1 o'clock, halfway there. There's a sign on the side of the road that said, truck stop 5 miles. And George says to me, he said, Bobby, he said, do you think we ought to stop in there and let the guys get a cup of coffee and a sandwich? I said, sure. So we pull into this huge truck stop, great big parking lot and everything up there in the mountains. And when the bus driver stopped the bus and turned on all the lights, all the guys were waking up. I blitzed George all the way across in that Hollywood Gin game. And he said, how about buying me a cup of coffee? You're too slick for me. And Hot Rod was waking up right behind us and heard him say that. And they started calling me that. That was back in 1958 or...
Yeah.
It stuck.
Isn't that amazing? Just that one little thing.
But I got it from a great man.
So, but anyway, you're in the NBA. You played 6 years, I think, before injuries forced you out.
Seven years. They gave me credit for 9 years because... They gave me credit for 9 because those 2 years in the military.
Oh, yeah. So credit for the pension you get in the pension.
For your pension, about. Yeah. They gave you credit for 9 years. Played 7. Separated this shoulder 6 times. And I just couldn't lift the arm up anymore. So I had to go into the coaching ranks.
But you had some success as a player. I read you scored 40 in an overtime game as a rookie.
The best scoring games I ever had. It's on a picture or something downstairs. I had 42 in a game against the St. Louis Hawks in the playoffs, and then I had another game, Madison Square Garden, against the Knicks. I had a 39-point game against the Knicks.
You were one game you played in at Madison Square Garden, Elgin Baylor had 71.
I've got cufflinks.
I was going to ask you.
He was a rookie and went into the Garden in New York and hit the Knicks with 71. That's how great this guy was.
And they gave cufflinks to everybody, right?
On he the gave team? Cufflinks, got 71 on them.
That's great.
Only thing is, I can't afford shirts that's got French cuffs.
Now, we would be completely remiss if we didn't tell the story of the famous plane crash that you lived through. It's the 1959-60 season, and the Lakers are flying from St. Louis back to Minneapolis after a game, and the plane goes down. I'll let you tell that story.
Well, we took off out of St. Louis. It's the only crash landing that a team has ever had, and I hope it never happens. We took off out of St. Louis after a ball game, going to Minneapolis. The only thing is, I know we lost, on takeoff, we lost all electrical equipment. Mm-hmm. Well, they couldn't go back in and land because, you know, Lambert Field in St. Louis was a big airport, and there were other planes coming in there, so we had to go. And all of a sudden, we get out there. Now, I remember it as night, real night. We get out there, and we hit a snow. It started getting cold in the plane. It started getting real cold. I think it was in February, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Started getting real cold. The guy's saying, fortunately, it was a C-47 or a DC-3 prop plane. And we had about 20-whatever on board. Start getting, turn on the heat. Well, there is no heat. Systems, everything's out. We run into a snowstorm. And the pilot, the co-pilot, now both these guys had flown missions in World War II. The co-pilot was sticking his head out the window to scrape the ice and everything off. So you had no defrost or none of that.
You walked up to see what was going on, and you stuck your head in the cockpit, and he's got his head out the window?
Yeah, he's got his head out the window scraping ice. He got a frostbitten side of his face from that. But we're up there, and we're lost now. We're lost. We're in a snowstorm. I remember one time we're flying so low that they were trying to figure out some place maybe it'd lead us into a town. The moon came out. The moon came out, and the snow stopped. And they were following a car, and this car was going up the hill all the time. All of a sudden, he yanks this thing, you know. Well, at any rate, we're running out of gas now. We're running out of gas. We've been up there 2.5, 3. You talk about a bunch of guys being scared. All kind of things go through your mind. Am I ever going to see Nancy and the kids again? And, you know, you didn't make no money in those days. What kind of shape you leaving them in? And all this stuff goes through your mind. And we're running out of gas, and all of a sudden, we see this town. The moon's out. And so they started. Now, you got to realize how low we're flying. You know those water towers that are up in these small towns?
Mm-hmm.
We're flying right a little bit, not very much above that. And we're buzzing this town. Well, all of a sudden, all the lights start coming on this town. Now, it's 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. And the lights start coming on, and then you start seeing the red lights. You start seeing whatever ambulance service or fire truck service they had in this town. We didn't know what town it was. And pilot had the cockpit door open, and he says, I think that's a cornfield down there. See, it was hard to read the terrain because of the snow.
Right.
So we buzzed that town twice. And he said, now we got to clear those high tension wires to be able to go in there into that cornfield. Oh, man. So he takes her in. And we hit that cornfield, and the shucks were up. I mean, this plane is tearing the daylights out of this, you know, sound like all hell's breaking loose. And all of a sudden, that plane tumped up on end, and bang, hit back down. Well, that co-pilot got to the back door and opened that door. You should see. Hey, if you wanted to see some crazy guys jump out. And that snow was up to your waist in that mm-hmm. cornfield. Mm-hmm. That snow was up to your waist. We're out there. We're so happy. We're throwing snowballs at each other and everything else. Well, the highway was a couple blocks away. And so we trudged through this cornfield to the highway, and I rode into town in the back of a hearse. There was all kinds of clothes.
But you're alive.
Yeah. And we go into this hotel, and the only hotel in town at that time, I guess, was this old retirement hotel. And here's these ladies in their nightgowns. You know, they wanted to see what was happening, and it wasn't that big. And there was a little bar there, seat about 6 people. And it had a liquor cabinet behind the bar, and had a padlock on it. We had a center by the name of Larry Faust out of LaSalle. He's passed away now. Big 6'9 guy. Larry went behind that bar, grabbed hold of that padlock, and just twisted it right off of there. Reached in there and got him a fifth of VO and poured himself a big glass and drank it straight down. But that was...
I mean, not too many, you know...
Hey, didn't, the good Lord wasn't ready for me.
Yeah, the snow probably saved you, right? I mean, you talk about 6 feet of snow.
It might have. But just to show you how it was then, a couple of weeks later, we took a bus from Carroll, Iowa to Minneapolis. That was the town, Carroll, Iowa. A couple of weeks later, we had a halftime ceremony for those two pilots. I said you didn't make no money in those days and that. Now here, these guys saved our lives. They saved our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Every guy chipped in $50. There's 10 guys on a team. We gave those guys $500, $250 apiece for saving our life.
Hey, that's something, though.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
There's more to the story because you guys went back, the next day and saw how close you were to real disaster.
Yeah, we if we'd gone another about 40 yards, there was one of those big stone ravines that dropped down out of sight. Had we gone another 40 yards, it'd been all over.
You would have gone down and over the cliff.
We would have gone down in there and probably exploded or whatever, although the gas was all gone.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows then. You know, let's face it, it wasn't our time.
Yeah.
It was not our time. And you know, the funny thing is, Bob Short had bought that plane.
He owned the franchise.
He paid this farmer that owned that cornfield, I forget the amount, had mechanics come in there and work on this plane and take a bulldozer and back it all the way up and bulldoze a runway out of there. They flew that thing out of there. Now, that's in February. By April, we're in the playoffs. We're in the playoffs. We're going, I forget the team that we were playing the first round of the playoffs. We go out to the airport. Guess what? There is that plane sitting there. And everybody said, we're not getting on it. We're not going to get on this baby. Short's there. And he said, if you don't get on, you're out of a job. We got on and flew that thing again. Well, I said, you know, I'm saying to Hot Rod and Dick Garmaker, I said, hey, lightning's not going to strike twice.
Yeah, what are the odds?
Right? Yeah, the odds are in our favor.
One-on-One's encore presentation with Slick Leonard continues in a moment. All right, hope you enjoyed this encore presentation of my 2009 conversation with Slick Leonard. His story and his stories are timeless, but there's no better time than now to hear them again. He'll go into the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Fame, on Friday in Springfield, Massachusetts, an honor that most people around here consider long overdue. You know, Slick's one of those rare people who's experienced so much in life, has so many stories, and is such a good storyteller that he literally could talk all day and never bore you. But we'll have to settle for 2 hours. I'll come back next week with part two of my conversation with Slick to discuss his coaching career with the Pacers and all that's happened since. You can hear it Sunday at 11 a.m. and Wednesday at 7 p.m. right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.